Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The White House on Wednesday signaled that Mexico, Canada, and other countries may dodge his plan to stiffen steel and aluminum import tariffs. The president told reporters on Tuesday that poor trade relations with the European Union was part of his motivation in the first place.
The European Union has been particularly tough on the United States. They make it almost impossible for us to do business with them, and yet they send their cars and everything else back into the United States. And they can do whatever they'd like, but if they do that, then we put a big tax of 25% on their cars, and believe me, they won't be doing it very long.
But tougher tariffs could be a double-edged sword for a state such as Ohio, where the steel industry still has a foothold, along with large consumers of steel, including the auto industry. Joining us by phone is steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania, Chris Plummer. Welcome back, Chris.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you.
Joining us as well, Columbus Dispatch business reporter Dan Guarino. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be here.
What do we know about why the president announced this last week? Can we get a sense of the timing and get our bearings here a little bit? Dan?
This is a long simmering issue.
This was campaign fodder.
This was campaign fodder. I mean, and this is an issue that has been around for decades in terms of questions of and accusations of steel from other countries being allegedly illegally subsidized by their governments and then getting dumped into the U.S. market and then lowering the market price of steel and harming U.S. producers is basically the line of reasoning. So and what's interesting about the specific timing now is, I mean, it probably was a bigger issue in terms of affecting actual steel companies a couple of years ago, or even more than that.
There's been huge layoffs over the last 10 years.
There have
layoffs,
been, yeah.
Shutdowns, closures, that kind of thing.
In particular with some Ohio steel producers, there were some very hard times, and there were some, this industry has contracted substantially, certainly based on, in terms of headcount, but it's actually not a terrible time right now. The timing of this is really interesting.
How have the markets responded, Chris Plummer? As Dan Guarino says, it feels like things had sort of evened out a little bit, and everyone was, you know, in the same place. But how have they reacted to this at this point?
I'd say, Ann, we're getting the sort of normal expected reaction from different parties on each side here. I think what's interesting is many of Trump's own party are objecting or offering caution just because of some of the ramifications that may or may not happen as a result of this. So it's sort of an interesting picture. Obviously, the steel companies and the aluminum companies are universally for this almost, or for the full extent of the measures being proposed. But as Dan was saying, this is people, even though the markets, at least for the flat-rolled companies that are making sheets and coils, and that's about two-thirds almost of the entire steel market, they're actually doing fairly well, operating at very high operating rates. Their earnings are as high as they've been in more than 10 years and so forth. But I think the steel and aluminum mills, as Dan was getting at, are looking at, you know, this is a cyclical business, and the downturns in the cycle have been, going back to the early 70s, have been very severe, and we've seen huge shakeouts in this market that are highly unusual in most industries. I mean, we've seen as many as 50% of the industry going bankrupt a couple of times in the last 10 or 15 years. So those are the things that steel mills are looking at, and they also want to be able to try to consolidate, upgrade their facilities, optimize their cost structures, and so forth. and feel they need some breathing room in order to do that, that they're feeling these Section 232 tariffs will provide.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the proposed tariff increases by President Trump. He's supposed to clarify his proposal or what his plan is later on today. My guest, Dan Guarino, business reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, and also Chris Plummer. He's a steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania. Dan Guarino, I mean, when we talk about the industry itself, the steel industry, all things being equal, the benefits that it may reap from any of these tariffs wouldn't necessarily go into returning all those people to work. Technology is king at this point, right?
Throughout a whole bunch of large manufacturing industries, you've seen this increase in productivity and you've seen this increase in efficiency where you're able to make more stuff with fewer people. And that's certainly been true in the steel industry. Mm-hmm. If there was, like Chris was saying, some breathing room, what you would most likely see is investments in equipment, investments in just some of these facilities are really kind of raggedy looking.
Right.
There's talk from these companies that they would bring back hundreds of workers or that this would lead to. And maybe something like that might happen in
maybe
the short
hundreds,
term.
Maybe hundreds, but thousands?
It would be hard to other than largely as a PR move, it just doesn't make that much sense. I mean, if it wasn't tied to this high profile event and you were to all of a sudden have this big infusion of cash to these companies, there is some underutilized capacity where they could make more stuff, but I'm curious if that's what they would really spend money on if all of a sudden they had this, which would be a sudden increase in income.
And Chris Plummer, what are the prospects that plants that have closed would actually reopen? That's very expensive. It's an expensive business.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking, depending on the mill type, but if you're looking at an integrated mill, and there are two that are completely closed down, either the entire operations or the so-called hot end, where you're making liquid iron or liquid steel. But yeah, you're right. Those are expensive to idle, bank, and then restart. It appears U.S. Steel has made some statements that it intends to start bringing back its Granite City, Illinois integrated steel plant that has over 3 million tons of annual capacity and makes primarily hot rolled coil, but other products as well. They're right across the Mississippi from St. Louis, and that plant has been idled since late 2015. And the estimates that we have and that we've seen are going to be that it will cost several million dollars to bring that back, to restart the facilities and everything else. And I understand they'll bring that back half. In other words, one of the two blast furnaces and steelmaking trains will be brought back initially, and then presumably the other, depending on how market conditions evolve over the next 3 to 6 months. The other plant, fairly large, that has been shut since the same time, late 2015, is the AK Steel Ashland, Kentucky plant, which is really almost half a steel plant. It just operates basically the hot end, you know, the molten side through slab making, which is the first solid, semi-finished form of steel. That also has a capacity upwards of 2.5 million tons per year. AK Steel, according as of this morning, everything that I've seen has indicated it still is going to wait and see what happens over the next few weeks or months before it decides whether to bring that plant back on. But beyond that, and beyond maybe some of the a little bit lower operating rates among the integrated mills, as I mentioned earlier, the flat-rolled market, that's sheet, coil, and plate, account for almost 65% of all the steel made and consumed in the United States. Those sectors are operating at a much higher rate, you know, well into the low to upper 80% operating rates than are the so-called long products like bars, beams, and rods, and things like that, that are now made exclusively by electric arc, EAF electric arc, so-called mini mills. So I think, as Dan was getting at, the question is there, beyond those two big plants and some maybe moderate slack capacity that's out there, there's not a huge amount of ability for the U.S. steel industry to really increase a lot of capacity quickly on that side. And then you have the issue as to whether the raw materials can be there to feed them. And I think our biggest issue is around iron ore, which is required for every ton of these big integrated steel these plants make. They need about 1.5 tons of iron ore. So you got all of these realities of what's already running, how much could be brought back, and some of the other constraints as to what really and practically can be changed in the next couple of weeks or months.
Dan Guarino, what the tariffs aren't going to affect, what impact it raises the prices of steel, whatever point it's finished, what impact does that have on the big consumers of steel, the auto industry?
So steel is one of these commodities where the price rises and falls, and the cost of the inventory that a lot of these companies have. The big issue when you see big swings in price is if you've got a whole bunch of inventory in your warehouse, all of a sudden the value of that just changed dramatically. In this case, goes up a lot. It's a great thing if you have a warehouse full of stuff.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden it's worth a lot more. So when you just announce tariffs like this, it has an effect on these markets. And you look at how it's had effect on the equity markets as well. So it's inevitable that it would lead to increases in costs for people who buy steel if the tariffs were actually implemented at the levels that are being discussed. The question is then how much of that gets passed on to consumers and how much of that just kind of gets eaten up in the process of the people who are making cars, the people who are making appliances and all of those things. Some of it would end up having to be passed on to consumers.
Which would affect demand.
You would think, yeah.
I'm talking economics 101 right here.
Yeah.
Price goes up, the demand goes down.
It would. It's funny because it's so much of this is if this actually happens in the way it's being described right now. And I think that's the big question mark. I think that it hasn't – the idea of this really happening at the level being described has not really been priced into the market yet. You know, and it's like – so, yeah, if there was a 25% and a 10% tariff – that was as wide-ranging as being described, yeah, it would have a dramatic effect, and it would affect pricing, I would think. But it's not clear yet that that's actually what's going to happen. And I think a lot of the different players who are both steel makers and steel consumers are thinking, you know, there's a chance something might happen, but it's probably not as substantial as. And then there's a secondary issue was, okay, so let's say that this tariff as described takes place. The question then is how long does it last? You don't do a tariff like this, and it doesn't go on forever. It doesn't go on. I mean, it's something like this is something that's substantial. You have issues of retaliation. You have you look at previous examples of tariffs. It would be a short term thing, most likely. So you've got two giant unknowns, and that's I think in the abstract you can say, yeah, it's going to raise consumer prices, but there's a lot of steps in between,
right?
And we don't know what those look like.
We're going to continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You just heard from Dan Guarino. He's a business reporter for Columbus Dispatch. And also with us, Chris Plummer, steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania. We're talking about the prospect of stiff new tariffs being imposed on steel and aluminum imports. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump today is expected to clarify plans for higher tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Since he announced a rough plan last week, the biggest skeptics have emerged from his own party. House Speaker Paul Ryan has advised caution, and the president's top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, announced in the wake of last week's revelation on tariffs that he would depart the White House. They have not been officially linked, though. We're talking about what this means for Ohio, a state where steel production remains in play, along with big steel consumers, as well as an agricultural industry that relies heavily on exports. Still with us is Columbus Dispatch business reporter Dan Guarino, and by phone, steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania, Chris Plummer. Joining us right now, Ohio State University economist Ned Hill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here.
In general, Ohio's economy is complicated when it comes to these tariffs. A knee-jerk reaction is, well, it's good for the steel industry. But beyond that, how do you see something like this hypothetically playing out?
Well, it is complicated because steel is at the base of the supply chain, and they're important to Ohio because the shipping distances from the plants to other users is short, but we're a big steel-using state. So the two automobile assembly plants in Marysville and East Liberty, the one up in Youngstown, the plants in Springfield is Toledo and Lorain. All those are big steel users, not to mention the appliance plants that we have in Clyde and Marion. So if the price of steel goes up, the price of their costs go up. And because it's steel so far down the supply chain, it's all their parts also go up. And that will cause a problem with them selling their goods. Here's the perfect example. The chairman and CEO of Toyota was down in Georgetown, Kentucky about a month ago, challenging the workforce and the Toyota folks down there to bring the cost of the Camry down, because it's now cheaper to build the Camry in Japan and ship it to the United States. Now, for Ohio, that's a big deal, because in the southwestern corner of the state, we've got a lot of Toyota supply chain. Well, you just made that problem 17 to 20% more difficult. I kind of guesstimated the numbers. And we have a booming production of the CRV in our area in Columbus. If that gets a lot more expensive, that can also come out of Canada or it can come out of other countries. So the ramifications for our manufacturing base are actually quite severe.
Let's talk about the fact that Canada and Mexico may have dodged a bullet on this. We're not sure yet, but it came out of the White House yesterday. People read the paper this morning. They see that they may be exempted from this, which was what they were asking all along, even though the president said, no way, not on this. It looks like he may have some flexibility. What's going into all of that right now? What would the effect be if Mexico and Canada weren't exempt? Would it be that much more troublesome?
Well,
or do the exemptions bode well, do you think, or what?
Well, the exemptions show that this is public policy being made on the fly. I mean, the president's announcement was like watching some fat guy do a cannonball on the low end of a swimming pool, and everybody's going to get wet. So let's think about it systematically. First off, Canada's the largest foreign steel provider to the United States. Second is Brazil. Mexico, I think, is third or fourth. I've got it with my data. I'll have to look it up. And the issue is those plants, Mexican and Canadian plants, are tightly tied into supply chain. So those good American cars by GM, which are actually made in Canada, are dependent on Canadian steel, and parts go back and forth the border. So it becomes a problem. And the other thing that is escaping this entire discussion, you would think that we don't make any steel here. We satisfy 76% of steel demand in the United States with U.S.-made steel.
Already. We were talking about that.
Yeah.
Right.
And U.S. 10% of U.S. production is exported, mostly to Canada, some to Mexico. So that's part of the reason to exempt those two. The realization is it would cause disruptions. The other reason is politics. The Steel Workers Union and the AFL-CIO are very closely connected with their Canadian unions. So unions are and the U.S. manufacturers with steel plants in Canada and Mexico are getting involved, and they're trying to build this airplane as it's flying.
And part of the equation, Chris Plummer, is that it's been we've heard that any kind of deal to exempt Canada and Mexico is contingent on tweaking a NAFTA deal with them.
That is correct. Yeah, and a huge part of overall NAFTA involves the auto industry. Just as a quick interjection, on the steel side, the U.S. has a net surplus of over 1 million tons last year with Mexico as a net exporter to Mexico, and just slightly negative with Canada. But a lot of what they supply to Mexico and Canada involves very high value-added coils for the automotive and appliance industry. But with that said, a big focus of Trump and his colleagues on renegotiating NAFTA relates to the auto sector. And currently, right now, based on the NAFTA agreements, the content, and there's a limited cap on the content, but the content of cars built in NAFTA has to, by NAFTA regulations, contain 62.5%, at least of the value, coming from or sourced from one of the three NAFTA countries. What Trump would like now is that 85% of the content or the value of the content be sourced from one of the three NAFTA countries, because it's, you know, those are the countries who signed the agreement and therefore should benefit from it. And of that, he would like 50% of that 85 being sourced from the United States, which is not necessarily unreasonable. If you look at the relative population size of each of the three countries, the size of the steel industry, the auto industry, and so forth, that are about twice that level, or that Trump could ask if he did it on that basis. So that's not necessarily unreasonable. The other reality is that out of that 62.5% NAFTA content requirement, many things are not tracked or traced, including, by the way, steel and a lot of the higher-priced electronics and other components that proportionately make up a lot of the average light vehicle. So in the end, based on our estimates and others that we've seen, when you get right down to the bottom line, if you look at the average car produced in NAFTA, only about 30% contains NAFTA content. And if you look at Mexico, just as one final point, the Mexican cars that are all the light vehicles produced in Mexico, the U.S. share of the steel is about 35% and has held at that level for a number of years. And the Mexican content is about 10%. The Canadian content is between 5 and 10. So what that means is that other countries outside of NAFTA have 45 to 50% of the steel content of cars built in Mexico. And again, they're not part of that agreement. So there are some merits to be made there. Whether these additional items can be tracked easily, I don't think it's necessarily a prohibitive problem for that. But that's kind of the gist of what the Trump administration is getting at with these NAFTA renegotiations.
And a lot of that steel that Chris is talking about is coming out of Brazil, because Brazil is the second largest exporter into the United States.
Of that 45%.
Right.
Okay. All right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the, I don't know what to say, it's proposed, potential, in the offing,
being tariffs. Made up on the fly.
Winging it. Tariffs that the president announced last week. He's going to clarify, apparently, that announcement today. We're expecting possibly exemptions for Canada and Mexico, our NAFTA trading partners. And but as we just heard from Christopher Plummer, that may be that because they're getting them to move on NAFTA negotiations. So let's hear from some callers now. Evan and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Evan.
Hey there. Usually I'm the guy calling in to support Trump with all the crazy leftists on, but this is just ridiculous. A 25% tariff on steel and aluminum? I mean, this is just nonsense. Tariffs hurt the country that they're implemented on. Sure, the steel industry's happy, but, I mean, then everybody else gets screwed over. It's like, you know, you put a 25% tariff on steel, okay, so now all Americans have to pay more for steel, but there's still all that steel out there, so the other countries get their steel cheaper because the supply outside of the United States is higher than it was the day before. And so they're getting cheaper steel, and they're just buying it from other places. And it's like trying to grow pineapples in Canada. We need to help our pineapple producers here in Canada, so we're going to put a 90% tariff on pineapple production.
Evan, let me ask you this. This is not news that Donald Trump wanted to impose these tariffs. He's been talking about this since the campaign. Did you just think he wasn't serious about it?
No, I'm not even that big of a Trump supporter. I mean, this is just, I'm a hardcore libertarian. Okay. Austrian economics brought me to libertarianism.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hear Ned Hill. What about those other countries that will be getting their steel cheaper? All things being equal.
Well, all things being equal, Evan's moving down the right track. What will happen is there'll be some increased demand for U.S. steel mills. There won't be much more employment. The workers will get some extra overtime. Capacity will go up. Chris talked to you about the mills are kind of on the edges. Actually, there's one in Mingo Junction that's close to reopening. They're working on their finance now. But what will really happen is our competitors will be able to bring in cheaper goods. Just think about what happened with Marion and Clyde with Whirlpool. They just benefited from a dumping charge against LG on washing machines and dryers. The cost of LG's machines went up by $50. Well, now this is going to change the cost relationship between Korea and the United States once again. So, you know, if you start doing tit-for-tat tariffs to protect special things, we could be reinventing the economics of 1928, 1929.
And, you know, even a short-term tariff, as Chris suggested, that this is probably not long-term. What's the difference between short-term and long-term when we're talking about these kind of tariffs?
When the revolt happens.
Okay.
short-term and long-term is you know, when does the WTO make you know, rule against us? And when the domestic politics work against it.
Well, in George W. Bush's case, he had a short-term tariff, not unlike this.
Correct.
And it ended why? Was it politics?
I'll say this to you, Ann. I just don't know.
Dan Garino, any thoughts?
I'm gonna have to go with Ned on that one. I mean, it's funny. I remember it
just
at
sort
the
of
time,
happened, then it quietly ended.
Chris.
All right, Chris Plummer.
Yeah, I would just say because that's what we do with this thing. If you look, and this gets back, I think Dan was talking about this earlier about the pricing. In fact, it's Dan and Ned. Is one of the things I always caution when people go back to that Bush VRA or the other VRAs and trade actions that happened earlier going back into the 60s, is you got to always look at what's the starting point. Mm-hmm. And when you looked at the Bush VRAs, remember, we just came off of a giant Asian or emerging economy financial crisis that began in 97, 98. And by the time Bush instituted the VRAs in March 2002, the U.S. steel industry was absolutely decimated. It was running at like 60% or less operating rate. Half of the industry, more than half, went bankrupt, and most of those those were liquidated. That's why we no longer have
Bethlehem Steel. That was the big contraction. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're looking at that, and the dollar was at a super high premium relative to other trading countries. And there's a strong inverse relationship in the price of steel or any commodity with the value of the dollar. What we have now, as I pointed out, and as both Ned and Dan collaborated, is the fact that, you know, at least for the flat rolled steel market, the steel industry is doing pretty well. They're in good to very good times in terms of operating rates, income, and so forth. The dollar is starting to weaken. It peaked in December 2016 and has been weakening for over a year. So that's propping up prices. Prices prior to this, I mean, right now, it's been pricing has moved up in both steel and aluminum as a result of these announcements. But prices are now at their highest level since almost 2008 already before we've got these. I think steel and aluminum companies themselves are, you know, freely admitting they expect the prices to probably go up as much or close to the percentage of the tariffs and that sort of thing. So I guess that's my one cautionary point, is always look at where you're starting from. And just one last comment on the prior Bush VRAs that he ended in December 2003. By that time, and really for about 6 months, it was obvious that the entire world of metals and industrial goods had changed, that we were on the cusp of a major commodity super cycle caused by China that was just really kicking in right at that point. So you had all these other factors. It's like, you know, somebody trying to say, you know, whether eating this percentage of fat in your diet contributes to this disease or that. Yeah. There are a lot of factors. So that's my only other comment that I would make to the point that your caller, Evan, was making, is I always look at four quick things that happen, either intentionally or people should be aware that these are pretty obvious, the makers of these laws, but there are generally four big consequences. One is retaliation, and it's in proportion to the magnitude of the trade action being imposed on them. But you can, one thing you can be certain is the retaliation will be swift, severe, and as painfully targeted as possible. In other words, foreign countries are going to look at who's up for re-election, what industries
are,
you know,
in their
agriculture,
state,
appliances, who's, you know, so
that's why we're hearing about Harley Davidson and Levi's jeans and that kind of a thing.
But one. Well, the other is the pricing that Ned was just getting, you know, and it's debatable how much, but, you know, I think even the steel and the aluminum mills concede that they'll probably get as much of that. But again, the U.S. premium for the same product serving the same market is now, let's say in hot rolled sheet, the bellwether product, it's over $150 a ton higher than in the European market and well over $200 in China. So you've got that issue. Thirdly, is that, and Ned got at this, is companies or countries are going to start exporting steel and aluminum intensive parts, components, and finished goods. So you've got a whole array of things coming at you now, not just steel and aluminum. And then finally, the fourth thing is that companies, foreigners, are going to start building plants here in the United States. There's nothing to stop you, and you're going to have these guys permanently in your backyard. That may take a couple of years, but those are the four big things that will happen, not can, but will happen.
Christopher Plummer, I have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's Christopher Plummer. He's a steel analyst and managing director of Metal Strategies, Inc. in Pennsylvania. We'll continue our conversation. We'll get to some calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Ohio might fare if the president goes through with a plan to increase tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Still with us is Columbus Dispatch business reporter Dan Guarino and OSU economist Ned Hill. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ned Hill, do you want to talk about anything that Chris Plummer said earlier as far as he talked about retaliation, pricing, exporting?
I think that Chris has all that done well. What is missing from this conversation is the fact that the demand for steel over the past 35 years has actually dropped. Steel has competitive products in terms of plastics and composites. The second thing is that we built out a country, so you need less steel. Third is that we have stopped reinvesting in infrastructure. So a lot of the pressure that the steel industry is feeling about is a demand side problem.
And by the way, China has built out its country, at least for now, and that's why they're able to, they don't have the demand they once did.
Right. So they supply, I'm sure you went through this, 49, they make 49% of the iron and steel. A lot of those plants are supported by the provinces. They don't want to lay off. And so the question is, where's that steel going to go? And that's kind of the cross-shipping issue.
Jim in Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ann. I've been enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk a few technical things. I know quite a bit about steel. You know, basically in this product group we're talking about is hot rolled 1020 grade steel. That's basically what's used in the fabrication of auto bodies, support members that make up a large majority of automobiles. That's just stuff. It's just stuff, stuff, stuff. You can buy it, you know, virtually on every corner. Now, my question then goes to what's going to happen with the high-end steels required for the military? Now, the military uses steel grades up through the 5,000 through 8,000 series of steel to build their equipment to meet battlefield requirements. Then you have a country like Sweden, which produces some of the highest grade tool steel in the world and ships it all over the world. And nothing has been said about those products.
Yeah, because the president, that's thank you, Jim, for that point, because the president is using this as a national, his argument is national security, that we need to have steel production ramped up in the United States, but we don't do that kind of high-end steel production in the United States.
No, we do. There are special grades of steel which one plant can make almost a large fraction of the world's supply. And so therefore, so high carbon steel has been this issue that it's very high carbon steel that's not involved with auto sheet has moved out of the United States. Well, that's largely because the demand for for that grade steel is elsewhere in the world. And so it makes a lot more sense to ship that into the United States.
Why is that demand elsewhere in the world? What is it?
Largely it's steel comes into the United States not only in slabs and coils, but also comes in products. So the steel is going to be largely produced where the products are made. So if you're doing very high-grade machine tools in Switzerland or Germany or Italy, that's going to support it. So that's part of the global.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Left out a word, but that's okay.
What word?
Never mind. I'm editing in my head, which is a bad thing to do.
Jim in Arlington, thanks a lot for your call. Let's talk about the retaliation piece of this. It's not just retaliating, you know, in kind. It's retaliating on another big industry in Ohio, right, Dan Guarino? Agriculture.
Well, you
or
look
it
at
it. Could.
It could, yeah. So agriculture is one of – and there's a number of industries in Ohio that could be harmed by retaliation. But you see – over and over again, that being one of the big threats whenever you have steps toward a trade war. At times, just the threat of significantly harming the markets for farmers is enough. It's to kind of make the sides kind of be like, okay, let's think about this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that would be a huge impact for Ohio and a whole bunch of other states that voted for the president. So
mm-hmm.
It would be, that's one of the threats that I think should concern people who support this policy.
How can trade wars work, though, when it comes to food? The countries still need the food.
Well, they're global competitors. Right now, our largest competitors in this hemisphere is Brazil and Argentina. As well as Russia is now also, when it comes to wheat, is a competitive marketplace. So the same way steel is a commodity, so is corn, soybeans, and wheat. Mexico could quite easily favor its purchases coming out of Brazil. And interestingly enough, one of the nations going to be hurt the most about even this revised tariff plan is going to be Brazil.
If they exempt Mexico. Canada, Mexico, and apparently some other countries, maybe Brazil, who knows? I mean, it's hard to know. We'll know by later today at some point. Critics of the president's plan, such as it is, such as we understand it, have said that why not go into a more targeted tariff? Why this broad spectrum slashing and burning of what's going on right now? Dan Guarino, what would a targeted tariff look like? What are they talking about?
Well, you would target specific countries and you would target specific products. So you would look at what. So if there's an allegation that in this case there are countries that are not following trade rules and are selling subsidized products,
which is what's against the rules.
Yeah, you find those products and you find those countries and you take specific actions against them.
And pretty much people generally know that that's China. So why not target it?
Well, it's China, but there's also cross shipping. So the decision or the market action that hurt the Lorraine pipe plant, and that was drilling pipe. And the ITA went to the International Trade Administration, went to the World Trade Organization, and found that there were billets coming out of China that were milled in Korea, stamped as if they were made in the U.S. and brought onto the market. And U.S. Steel claims that that was the what put the Lorraine mill out of business, and that was an $850 million investment. Now, the reality was it also happened as the drilling in the shale fields began to slow down.
But
we had two Ohio plants. The Timken plant in Faircrest also was affected by international dumping of pipe and forging. And there's been allegations and maybe a case or two about forged stampings on Indian pipe as well. So, pipe is a commodity. As soon as it has a stamp that says it meets certain strength standards, then it's traded openly. There's also been complaints about billets coming into Canada and so China essentially shipping billets into Canada, then getting manufactured coming into the United States through the back door. So
that could still happen too, right?
That can definitely still happen. And the Canadians are pledging good behavior. Trust us, we will stop it. Trust but verify, I think President Reagan once said. And that's the reason, to me, that the largest issue is we need a much speedier WTO process.
World Trade Organization.
World Trade Organization.
How so?
Well, because by the two, three, 4 years it takes to get a decision, the plant's closed.
Okay.
And that is where the real frustration's coming in.
Why does it take so long?
That you'd have to ask a lawyer.
Well, it's a complicated process too.
With a
WTO case, it isn't like you can just brief it in a week and come to a decision in a few months. The discussion we've had today is just gives some hint at the complexity of what's being discussed. So it's like, there is this problem where cases take too long, but how do you speed it up? You could speed it up, but it's complicated stuff.
The president's supposed to announce something today at 3:30. We don't know what, so we don't know. But it could hypothetically he impose these tariffs and they could go into effect in a matter of weeks or months. Is that how fast it could happen?
The president has the authority.
Why does the president have this authority?
That's another good. We should have brought a lawyer with us.
Where are the lawyers? We need to.
Yeah, I mean, it has something to do with the legislation. So outside of that,
because Congress is sort of saying, "Hey, there's not much we can do except send this letter with 103 signatures on it." Saying
that's correct.
Really?
Well, this is through an administrative agency where that has the authority. So you that's part of the executive branch. So it it's kind of why they could
put the kibosh on the other agreement that they've been working on for 2 years with the Pacific Rim countries. That why that could just end.
No, I think that the difference here is that is being. Brought underneath the title of national defense.
Right.
And so that there is a strategic industry for defense purposes is the excuse for bringing this through. And if you look at the data, the fact that we produce 75% of the steel that we use, the military actually controls the demand side. The military can actually buy more steel or could pay to mothball some plants and keep it on a hot idle.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other things to be done. I mean, this is a transparent, convenient excuse.
The relationship with the European Union, how critical is that?
I would think it's huge. There are 28 countries there, and the 28 countries in Europe are the second largest steel producer in the world. We have trade reasons. We've got defense reasons. Having to declare a trade war what appears to be against most of our closest allies is a bit confusing.
Yeah. They've responded vociferously.
Like, absolutely.
No.
Well,
and you will suffer.
Right now, every week, a freighter comes down Lake Erie and docks in Cleveland and unloads European steel. And it is grades that aren't necessarily made in the United States. You've got the Osler Middle plant going in Cleveland, going great guns. That steel comes out of Rotterdam. So that is just another part of the trade relationship. And getting in that way would cause problems. The other thing is Europe now doesn't trust the United States. And Europe doesn't want to see a global trade war. And it's a slippery slope. President Trump has put the banana peel right at the top of it.
I know the steel industry has said pretty uniformly, this is good, this is great, but they have to see the larger ramifications of this, don't they, Dan Guarino?
They do, but it's like there are people within the industry and trade groups that have been asking for, if not the specific details, policies along these lines for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not – when you get something that is pretty close to what you've wanted – you're not going to criticize the details that you think may be ill-advised, I suspect. You would expect them to defend this policy
because it's what they've been asking
for. In public policy, we talk about a policy window opens, and that window opens for a short time, and those people are getting ready for that policy window. They will jump right through it.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today to talk about it again. Ned Hill is a professor and economist at Ohio State University. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And Dan Guarino, business reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to hear this program again, you can go to our website at WOSU.org and check out our archives, or you can listen to it on a podcast. It's free. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.